Good afternoon. I'm Doug Cox, and on behalf of the D.C. Lawyers Chapter, welcome to our July luncheon. It's amazing we attract such a very, very good crowd on a hot day in summer, coming right off the end of a holiday weekend. It's good to see that not everyone is overseas seeking asylum. Now, the Edward Snowden case, I think, is unusually relevant for people who follow the Supreme Court, because it's been so unsettling. At this time of year, when someone seriously injures vital national interests, then jets overseas to lecture us about American values, we're used to it being the Supreme Court justices. So this year it's different, and that's upsetting for the Supreme Court bar. By contrast, events in Egypt will strike many Supreme Court watchers as nothing out of the ordinary. True, the spectacle of a democracy discarding its elected leadership and suspending its constitution and installing a Supreme Court justice as its functional head may strike some people as dramatic, but for those familiar with the work of Justice Kennedy, it's just another week in June. But despite all this, we do maintain tradition in this chapter, and in July, we traditionally sponsor a roundup of the recent Supreme Court term. This year, we are delighted and honored to have as our guest Miguel Estrada. This is Miguel's second turn in the barrel after an appearance back in 2011. Miguel began his experience before the Supreme Court, as many do, as an assistant to the Solicitor General. Upon returning to private practice at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, Miguel's gone on to have 7 more arguments, winning 5 of them. That's all the more notable when you consider that his only 2 losses came first in the death penalty case, in which he was representing a convicted murderer, and second in Dorsey versus United States, a case in which he was appointed by the court to defend the judgment below after the Justice Department refused to do so. Dorsey involved the potential retroactive effect of recent amendments to the sentencing guidelines for crack cocaine offenses. Miguel argued against retroactivity and thus for retaining harsher penalties for some crack criminals. He managed to get 4 justices to agree with him. Most recently, he argued in 1 Comcast versus Barrett, an important class action decision that requires district courts to determine that there is indeed evidence supporting a class-wide measure of damages before proceeding to certify a class. That case was also 5-4. The difference between Miguel's win in Comcast and his loss in Dorsey was, no surprise, the vote of Justice Kennedy. Otherwise, the lineups were identical. So if we put aside the convicted murderer and the crack criminals, Miguel's win rate in cases for more typical private sector clients is 100%. Even the media have recognized Miguel's very great legal skills. The Legal Times has named Miguel one of the nation's top appellate litigators, noting that people who follow appellate practice in Washington have known for several years that Estrada is one of the best around. Washingtonian Magazine named him one of the top constitutional lawyers, one of the true rising stars of the legal profession, who could become one of the legends of the Supreme Court bar. James Carville got into the act and famously referred to Miguel on television as Alberto Gonzalez. Evidently, in the liberal mindset, there's only room for 1 conservative Hispanic lawyer, and we may as well call them all Alberto. And they all look alike to Carville anyway. In 2010, Chambers named Miguel one of the handful of attorneys ranked in the very top tier among the nation's leading appellate lawyers, describing him, quote, an unbelievably smart attorney with a creative approach to cases and a real fighting spirit. In May of this year, he was picked as Litigator of the Week by the American Lawyer for his work on behalf of Comcast, both before the Supreme Court and in the D.C. Circuit. Needless to say, being chosen as Litigator of the Week is one of our profession's highest honors. Miguel is so persuasive that his arguments sometimes lead to unforeseen consequences. Years ago, for example, he told a young lawyer to go work for John Roberts, who was then still in private practice. As the anecdote has it, Miguel told the young lawyer to seek out John G. Roberts. The G is for God. The young lawyer was persuaded and took the advice. But unfortunately, this anecdote found its way into print during the 2011 Supreme Court term, and evidently the chief saw it, and he too was persuaded. Miguel graduated from Harvard Law School. He clerked for Judge Kearse on the Second Circuit and for Justice Kennedy. His public service includes not only his clerkships and his tour of duty in the Solicitor General's office, but also several years as a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. He is a trustee of the Supreme Court Historical Society and a member of the Board of Visitors of the Harvard Law School. At Gibson Dunn, he is co-chair of the Appellate and Constitutional Law Practice Group. Of course, in addition to his Supreme Court work, Miguel also has an active practice in the appellate courts. Among other cases in the D.C. Circuit, he, along with Noel Francisco of Jones Day, successfully attacked the President's somewhat unusual habit of making recess appointments when the Senate was, in fact, not in recess. In that case, Miguel represents the Republican senators. Rumor has it that there was a resolution to have him represent the Senate Democrats as well, but somehow it never came to a vote. In any event, we are delighted that Miguel's with us today. Miguel.
Thank you, Doug, for that very warm introduction. I am very, very thankful that you did not, as 2 years ago, said that my presence here showed that, you know, I was here to do, you know, the job that native-born Americans just would not do. These remarks were unduly generous, as I'm sure you could tell from the laughter at all the Gibson Dunn tables. But I am very happy to be here with you again. A lot of things happened. I'm going to take this not because I'm expecting a call from the president, but because it's my only way to tell time. Justice Kagan shot a deer while hunting with Justice Scalia. Justice Breyer had yet another bicycle accident. There was no one else involved, not even a tree, I think. And no one saw this, but I'm pretty sure we all know he fell to the left. Justice Sotomayor has shot to the top of the charts with her memoir, My Beloved World. I'm sure you're all going to go buy it immediately. It's been very well reviewed. For those of you considering a run for the Senate on the GOP ticket in South Carolina, Florida, or Arizona, you can buy it as Mi Mundo Adorado. This is the first time that a memoir by a Supreme Court justice has been simultaneously issued in two languages, English and Spanish. Some years ago, Active Liberty, which was a Halloween prank by Justice Breyer, was also issued in a small printing in Ferengi, which I am told is the language spoken in the justice's home planet. It did not sell well there, though, in fairness, it didn't sell that well in English either. Now, I understand that with all of these things going on, the court still had time to get to some cases, and we're going to talk about some of those today. But before we do that, there is a tradition of these events, which you probably know about, which was started by my esteemed colleague, Ted Olson. Every year, before we get to the actual roundup, we do a little review of the last year's headlines, looking for public hypocrisy, false sanctimony, and generally embarrassing behavior by public officials. No term can go by, and especially one that includes a presidential election, without an unlimited number of gaffes by our benighted Vice President, Joe Biden. I will not take, you know, the whole hour going through them. That would be just the top hits. But, you know, there are a couple of them that that do deserve to be mentioned because, you know, it was a very good year for him. You know, the first one is when he said at a campaign event, "Folks, I can tell you I've known 8 presidents, 3 of them intimately." We finally know the secret of his success. On a speech on the inauguration day, he said he was very proud to be President of the United States. At another event, he was talking about domestic violence, which is a very difficult problem and a very grave one. He was instructing people on how to look for telltale signs of domestic violence and to tell that this is just not your garden variety slap in the face. As someone looked stunned, he looked, not that that would be okay either. But of course, you know, it is those moments where the Delaware senator trolling for votes comes out, which must so please, you know, the White House. You know, my favorite one is when he gave, you know, the following interview to Parents magazine, and it went something like this. "If you want to protect yourself, get a double barrel shotgun. Have the shells and a 12-gauge shotgun. And I promise you, I've told my wife, we live in an area that, in the woods that is secluded. I said, Jill, if there's ever a problem, just walk out on the balcony, walk out and take the double barrel shotgun and fire 2 blasts. You don't need an AR-15, it's harder to handle. If you want to protect yourself, buy a shotgun, buy a shotgun." This was very pleasing to the White House, I am told. Now, for the 3 prizes we normally give, I'm going to try to go through them quickly. The bronze medal goes to Mark Sanford, who has proven that it is possible to be a Republican governor, claimed to be missing in the Appalachian Trail hiking, be found in Argentina with your Argentine mistress, and still have a bright future in the Homeland Security Committee. And people are worried about the NSA. The silver medal goes to Dana Milbank, who is a Washington Post columnist, as you may know, who does not get, who does not let facts get in the way of a good drive-by slander. Recently, Mr. Milbank wrote about what he called the churlishness of Justice Alito's making faces while his colleagues were reading dissent from the bench. This is a claim that is all the rage on the left these days. It was actually started by Gary Epps at The Atlantic. Dana Milbank had his own column on it. He went through the same facts as Epps had, but maybe because recycling other people's stories is not considered journalism, even at the Washington Post, he felt that he had to add his own reporting. So he claimed that he personally watched Alito demonstrate his disdain for Elena Kagan when she made a joke about the opinion that she was announcing. He quoted the joke, and then he said that seated, let me see, the actual quote is, "Justice Alito, seated at Kagan's right elbow, glowered." The only problem with this story is that on the date of the joke in question, Justice Alito was in Texas giving a speech and at a baseball game. But it was a very good story for the Washington Post. It may show that Mr. Milbank is ready for the Jason Blair chair in fabulism if the New York Times editorial board is ready to give it up. Finally, our first prize goes to the same person I gave it to a couple of years ago, Anthony Weiner. You may recall that a couple of years ago, he shot to stardom by taking photos of his private parts and putting them on a public Twitter page. thinking of a good alibi, he first claimed that his Twitter page had been hacked by Al-Qaeda. He then claimed that the pictures were actually of him, but it was okay because somebody else took them. Then he finally owned up to the cover-up, a little late. But now he has found that he has no other talents other than to take the taxpayer cash to live on, and so he's running for mayor of New York. You probably don't know this, but he launched his campaign for mayor with a very nice ad that had the skyline of Pittsburgh. Now, it is clear that he is targeting the undiscerning demographic of those voters who not only do not recall who he is, but also don't know where they live. He will surely garner all the votes of everyone who deserves him as a mayor. Now, let's talk through the term. It was a very important term. There were a lot of big cases. A couple of years ago, I had a very boring term to talk to you about. I was concerned that the only thing that happened that was interesting was that Justice Ginsburg finally talked everybody else to fall asleep with her on the bench. But this year, we had a really interesting term that is best exemplified by this headline from The Onion. Impatient nation demands Supreme Court just get to gay stuff. Before we get to the gay stuff, though, we have to go. Well, we're not really going to get to the gay stuff. Before we get to the gay stuff, we have to get to some of the stats. Now, I won't spend that much time on them because you can go on Scott's blog and see all the number crunching. The court was not working all that hard. They had 73 merits opinion after oral argument and 5 summary reversals. There was 1 dig. The court overturned the lower court 72% of the time. So contrary to what the court tells you, that they don't take cases to correct errors, they don't seem to take them to affirm either. As it is its destiny, the Ninth Circuit led the pack with the largest numbers of reversals for a total number of 12. There were other circuits with a much smaller number of cases that got reversed a lot. Some of them are not really fair. The First Circuit got overturned 100% of the time, but they only had 1 case. The largest share of agreement between the justices was between the female justices, who voted with each other 93.5% of the time. These things change every year. You may recall that a couple of years ago, some of the conservative justices, and in particular, I believe Justice Alito and the Chief Justice, had very close alignments with each other. One interesting note that has been pointed out by Scott's blog is the largest number of questions asked at oral argument. Justice Sotomayor has shot past Justice Scalia to ask a total of 21.6 questions per argument, which is about 1 every 3 minutes for 1/9 of the bench. Justice Thomas, as is usual, was at the bottom of that list, though this year, after a long hiatus, he did say something on the bench, which was amusing to all. He heard it during the argument in Boyer versus Louisiana, an ineffective assistance of counsel that the court ended up digging. Justice Thomas joked that, you know, the fact that the attorney for the criminal had been graduated by the Harvard Law School was probably evidence that he was indeed incompetent. Jeff Toobin, of course, took to the pages of the New Yorker to write an armchair psychoanalysis showing or purporting to show that this demonstrates that Justice Thomas is still angry at Yale Law School. Toobin's article doesn't make a lot of sense, but it does show that the left is still angry at Justice Thomas. Now let me see. We usually talk about the performance of the Solicitor General's office. I have a very high amount of affection and very high regard for the incumbent Solicitor General. I'm sad to report that the office, which is my former office, did not do very well at the Supreme Court this year, which is indeed unusual. The Solicitor General had 12 wins and 15 losses in the cases in which they appeared as a party, and 18 wins and 17 losses in cases in which they appear as amicus. And so for a party, their rate of success was a shockingly low 44%, and their blended success was an equally shockingly low 47%. They would have done better if they picked their arguments by lot or by coin toss. Now, what explains this? They have really good lawyers, and the court, contrary to what people claim, is not all that right-wing. But the only possible explanation lies not so much on the lack of capacity of the lawyers involved, but on the wackiness of the positions being urged by the incumbent administration. If you have a crazy client that insists that you make crazy arguments and you go along, odds are you're going to lose. And I think that covers all of the preliminaries. It was a very active case, for business cases, and we have a whole bunch of them to cover, so let's go through them quickly. Court had a few class action cases. Doug has already mentioned Comcast versus Berend. That was a 5-4 case, and the importance of the case, which makes it interesting and perhaps important in future cases, is the fact that in many of the lower courts, it has become a stock line to say that individual question of damages do not, quote, necessarily preclude class cert. That may well be true as far as it goes, but in practice, what it tended to mean is that individual questions of damages never precluded class certification. And this case now stands for the proposition that those types of damages questions have to be thrown into the hopper in the analysis of 23B3 and understanding whether the class action mechanism is indeed a superior one. The court had a second class action case, Amgen, in which the issue was whether the question of materiality is one that must be proven by the proponent of the class at class cert. As you may know, that is an element of the fraud claim itself, but is also, in an instance of double dipping, an element of one of the things that the plaintiff has to show to rely on the fraud on the market theory. And you know, the claim was that insofar as you're using materiality to get the fraud on the market theory, you have to prove it at the class cert, because otherwise reliance will be an individual factor that would preclude class cert. The court disagreed with that proposition. It pointed out that whichever way it turns out, there is only going to be one answer at the end of the day if a class is certified, and therefore you can put the question of materiality to the jury without really having to show it as an element of the fraud in the market theory at class cert. That is fairly uninteresting as far as it goes, though very important. The interesting part of it is that there were two justices, Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, who used this case as an opportunity to call into question whether the fraud in the market theory is a theory that the court should continue to adhere to. They cited to economic literature that has come out since the 80s when Basic versus Levinson was decided, that pointed out that maybe the markets are not all that efficient after all, and certainly not in every case enough to justify dispensing with proof of reliance. A third case involving class action was Standard Fire versus Knowles. in this case, you know, the court dealt with the CAFA statute, which permits you to take certain cases out of the state courts when they're filed as a class action. One of the things that has to be true about the case is that the case, in many of these cases, has to exceed a damages of $5 million. And the question in this case was whether a plaintiff could keep a case in state court by filing an affidavit saying that he did not intend on behalf of the class to seek more than $5 million. The answer to that, 9-0, is no. You may not do that because the affidavit, even if it binds the name party, does not and cannot bind the absent members of the uncertified class, and therefore the defendant is entitled to show that the case indeed does involve more than $5 million and get it into federal court. Our final class action case, which again is interesting, is General Healthcare versus Zimzik. This one was not, strictly speaking, a class action, but a collective action under the FLSA. The issue was, if you get a collective action that has not been certified, as it were, may the defendant make an offer of judgment to the plaintiff for everything that the plaintiff individually seeks in order to get rid of the case. Based in part on certain concessions made by the plaintiff in the court below, the court held that the case had become moot and that the plaintiff who had filed the case does not have any sort of right to bring the case on behalf of others once his own claim has been satisfied by the offer of judgment. Now, there is something about Comcast and this case that I think is worth highlighting because I think it is a trend that is worth noting about some of the left of center justices. In the Comcast case, Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer read dissents from the bench, which is fairly unusual. Justices do it only if they feel especially strongly about the outcome of the case, and yet their joint dissent for four members of the court took pains to say that the Comcast case was a ticket for this right only. It changes no principle of law, notwithstanding the oral dissent from the bench, and nothing happened today. In the Zimzik case, once again, Justice Kagan wrote a dissent saying, this is a case that is based only on the unusual facts and concessions of this plaintiff. Nothing happened today. This case doesn't give any roadmap as to how to do anything. I only mention that because it's a very, very crafty thing for the left of center justices to do. Contrast and combine type of dissent with what Justice Scalia does in some of his cases. In some of the cases that we'll be discussing later, like, you know, the gay stuff, Justice Scalia is not merely willing to lose the instant case, but he's already told you how he's lost, you know, the next three. Now, the liberal justices do quite the opposite. They say, we haven't even lost this one. It was an unusual case. It was sui generis. This doesn't apply. Nothing happened today. Move along. And it's an interesting insight because they're playing for time. They think that they're going to have help on the court. And Justice Scalia is acting as somebody who's running out of time. And it's a very different approach to the issues of the day, and one which may or may not work for the liberal justices once the Senate and the House give the Democrats 30 more million votes. That covers the class action docket. There is another very important case, which surely you have read about, is called Kiobel. Kiobel deals with a 1789 statute, the Alien Tort Statute, which is a statute that allows tort actions for violations of the Law of Nations. This is a statute that is sort of a mystery. It was passed in 1789 by the first Congress. It had not been used until the 1970s when the Second Circuit sort of founded in dealing with some of the human rights abuses in South America, and it has since then, you know, become, you know, the darling of the human rights left. Some years ago, in one of his last cases, Justice Souter wrote a case called Sosa, which tried to put some limits on the case, but nonetheless went on to say that they were not shutting, as he put it, the door down. He wanted to leave it, as he put it again, ajar. So now comes Kiobel, which was argued in front of the Supreme Court twice. It was argued first in the last term when the issue was whether the Second Circuit had been right in concluding that you could not sue a corporate defendant under the law of nations because there was no corporate liability for that sort of conduct at common law. Now, the second time it was argued, you know, the court asked whether the statute actually has extraterritorial application, and ultimately, when the decision issued, it was in part unanimous and in part 5-4. You know, the court concluded that the statute does not have extraterritorial application, so that a suit by foreigners against foreign and U.S. companies for alleged human rights abuses that were allegedly committed in Nigeria could not be filed here under the statute. That's a huge change for this sort of law. It's a very important case. We had a couple of cases that are important in the arbitration area. You have the very, very, very important case, which I'm sure you all have heard about. It's called Nitro Lift Technologies, which involved a summary reversal of the Supreme Court of Oklahoma I think it's called flipping the bird at the Supreme Court of the United States. You know, the Supreme Court of Oklahoma thought it was very clever by saying that it was going to decide for its own whether certain non-compete agreements were in fact allowed, where, you know, the question was whether that should go to the arbitrator himself. They thought it was being very clever by writing an opinion that sort of emphasized that they were dealing only with issues of state law, and that there was a clear, adequate, independent state ground, so the Supreme Court could not intervene. That caused, you know, the Supreme Court to say, oh, really? Let me sort of explain to you how when you thumb your nose at a federal statute, that's not an independent state ground, and summarily overturn the Supreme Court of Oklahoma. There was a case called Oxford that involves, once again, a question of arbitration, which went poorly for the defendant. In the Oxford case, the defendant had agreed in the courts below that the question whether class arbitration was allowed was for the arbitrator. The case went to arbitration, and the arbitrator promptly concluded that the answer to that question was yes. Oxford then went into federal court under Section 10 of the FAA, saying you have to set that aside under an earlier case called Stott-Nielsen. The Supreme Court 9-0 says, no, you don't. We sort of agree that what the arbitrator did is an outrage under the contract, but so long as he purports to be interpreting the contract, we have no warrant to intervene. You, Oxford, bargained for the arbitrator's construction of this contract, and you now have to live with it. The third important case on arbitration, this is getting sort of dry, isn't it? Maybe I should have had, you know, pictures of Anthony Weiner. The third and most important case in the arbitration docket is the Italian Colors case. Long story short, there has been a series of cases that started in the 80s with a case called Mitsubishi that said that you cannot use arbitration if you would in fact deny effective vindication to a federal right. So a whole bunch of merchants sue Amex, and their basic claim is that Amex is engaged in a tying. It forces you to take their least attractive cards if you want their actually attractive card, and that this is a violation of the antitrust laws. They also come into court and they say Amex is not entitled to send us to arbitration because the only way to vindicate these important antitrust claims is to have a class for us to hire, you know, the usual cast of economic experts will cost between $500,000 and $1 million. You know, the claim of a mom and pop shop like Italian Colors is maybe $50,000-$60,000. It is uneconomical for us to have this claim individually. The court 5-4 said no. This is not a good way to get out of arbitration. As Justice Kagan said, you know, the answer that the court was, yes, you cannot have this claim, and it's too darn sad. And that's sort of true. That's what the court did. I mean, the court said you bargain for the arbitration, and you also bargain not to have class arbitration. And under the FAA, we're going to enforce that contractual right. This is a very significant cutback of the effective of vindication doctrine, and it does mean that the court is firmly on the side of arbitration. We had a few cases involving intellectual property. Since you're all beginning to seek more coffee, I think I'm going to go through them pretty quickly so that I can get to the gay stuff. There are a couple of them that I think are worth mentioning. There was a blockbuster case on the patentability of DNA. Now, for those of you who don't follow the patent bar as actively as I'm sure Doug does, there is a doctrine in patent law called the law of nature doctrine. You cannot patent, you know, the law of gravity. You cannot patent a natural phenomenon. So you have to use nature to invent something that's actually useful. You cannot simply claim a patent for what is in essence a discovery. So the question comes up whether you can patent DNA, and the answer is twofold. You know, the court says, per Justice Thomas, no, you cannot patent naturally occurring DNA, because all you're doing is taking credit for the work of nature that's not patentable. However, cDNA, which is a synthetic form of DNA, may be patentable because that involves human intervention in coming up with something useful that actually does not exist in nature. Slate was so impressed with Justice Thomas's efforts on that opinion that it actually wrote an article admiringly saying that Justice Thomas is just not just a Tea Party mouthpiece. There was the case Bowman versus Monsanto, which has to do with patented seeds. If you're a farmer and you buy them, you're not entitled to keep replicating them on your own land. You have to buy them again. There is a very interesting and important case, which is one of the hallmarks of Justice Breyer. It's called FTC versus Actavis. And the issue in this case is whether if you have a patent as a drug manufacturer and you get into a lawsuit with a generic who wants to get at the product and claims that your patent is invalid, what happens when the brand name pays off the generic and all as part of a settlement? Now, the Court of Appeals in this case had very reasonably said, look, a patent is a monopoly. You cannot have an antitrust claim for something that the law gives as a monopoly anyway, even though it is the government in the form of the FTC suing. And so if this claim would have been vindicated as a patent claim, that is to say if the patent is valid and enforceable, then you could not have an antitrust suit. In an opinion by Justice Breyer, he says, yes, you can. And he doesn't quite tell us why, but in a hallmark of some of his best work, he tells us that there are five considerations that taken together all add to this and all have to do with the fact that we have to honor antitrust policy. Now, the Chief Justice wrote a very entertaining dissent going, wait, we can just ask if the patent is valid, and if it's valid, this is okay, right? But Justice Breyer, no, there are five considerations that taken together, but not in isolation, lead us to think that sometimes this may be a valid antitrust claim. For those long-suffering judges in the lower courts and members of the bar, we'll spend the next 20, 30 years finding out which of the five actually matter, if any. But that's the Supreme Court for you. There were a couple of important preemption cases. I doubt that this audience will care that much about them. There was one in which, you know, the one case in the First Circuit that got overturned when the First Circuit had concluded that there was no actual conflict between federal law and state law because the drug manufacturer could comply with both simply by not making the drug. Now, the court, oddly, was 5-4 on this question and concluded that, no, that doesn't really work because that would do away with all of the preemption doctrine. That was Mutual Pharma versus Bartlett. There were a couple of fascinating cases involving the Federal Aviation Authorization Act, which are completely forgettable, except that one of them was used by Justice Kagan in an example of what is it that the city was doing, which was you must post a sign on your truck. She had, you know, the number of the Tommy Two Tone song Jenny in the court's opinion. And so now you don't know that much about the Federal Aviation Authorization Act, but you do know that Jenny is a trucker living in Los Angeles. We had a couple of important cases involving employment. Some of these cases were the ones that caused Justice Ginsburg, to dissent from the bench and got the ball rolling for the Dana Milbank, Jason Blair chair thing. In the first one, UT Southwestern Medical Center versus Nassar, the court ruled that Title VII retaliation cases must be judged by the same principles of but-for causation as it had previously held in the Gross case. Age discrimination cases are judged. In the second one, Vance versus Ball State University, the court held that only somebody who has actual authority over tangible employment decisions like firing, hiring, and promotion is a supervisor who's suitable for the imputation of vicarious liability. Both of those cases were 5-4. Justice Ginsburg felt very strongly about them. She dissented from the bench in both of them. She once again pulled out, you know, the Ledbetter card and asked her friends in Congress to come to the rescue so that we will not live in a terrible world in which only people who supervise you are your supervisors. The court had three takings cases. They're sort of all interesting, but you know, we need to make time to get to the gay stuff. And so, you know, the only thing that's interesting about that is that the government lost all three of them. We need to get to the criminal docket, which was a good chunk of the court's docket. You know, they had a good number of criminal interesting cases this term. The summary quickly is that it involved dogs and bodily fluids. First, you know, the dog cases. You know, the first one is Florida versus Harris. This is a weighty question where the dogs lie. Do dogs lie? The Florida Supreme Court, in an opinion by our very old friend, Justice Barbara Pariente, I'm sure many of you have fond memories of the Florida Supreme Court and her interventions. Is Michael Carvin here? Had ruled that in order to have probable cause based on a dog alert, you needed to have a full background investigation of the dog. You needed to show how he did on the field, how often he got it right. You know, it was somewhat akin to what the court used to have for those people who went to law school in the Stone Age for informants, which was the old, you know, Aguilar-Spinelli rule, where you have to verify every aspect of the informant because, you know, Fido might be lying. The court took that case and concluded that no, this is just a probable cause case, and if you showed us how you trained the dog, that's good enough. You are free to cross-examine and impeach, but you don't need to have the pedigree and the kennel sort of genealogy or anything like that. The second case in the dog category is Florida versus Jardines, which is the dog on your porch case. This is a case that the criminal defendant won. It basically involves a cop taking a dog up your front yard and to your front door, having them smell all over the place, and figure out that you're in fact growing pot in your house. The court, led by Justice Scalia, looked at this as a property rights case, which is his new take on the Fourth Amendment, and he said that, sure, you can go up to the door and knock if you're the postman or a Jehovah's Witness or somebody else, but everybody understands that the implicit invitation of hanging a knocker on the door is come, knock, see if somebody's there, and leave. You're not invited to come in with a highly powerful object, Fido, in search for drugs. That was 5-4. The one thing that's interesting about that case is that it is, for the second term in a row after the Jones case, the GPA case, one of those cases in which Justice Scalia has avoided going with the CATS framework and the expectation of privacy framework and has centered the entirety of his analysis on the text of the Fourth Amendment, you know, papers, effects, houses, et cetera, and said that this is really an invasion of the property right. He has been very clear that that is a core right of the Fourth Amendment and that the CATS may be an added benefit, but it's not at the core of the amendment. Excuse me. Then we have the drunk driving case, Missouri versus McNeely. Guy was swerving and speeding, gets stopped. He's offered a breathalyzer. He says, no, thank you. He gets taken to the hospital when, over his objection, he's made to give blood, which shows that, hello, he was drunk. He is ultimately convicted, and the court ultimately holds that the conviction must be set aside. Now, what the court says is that the dissipation of alcohol in the blood that occurs naturally is not an exigency that, that justifies the cops for not getting a warrant. For those of you who went to law school and to whom this sounds vaguely sort of, I sort of studied this, you may be right. There is a case called Schmerber versus California that involves astonishingly similar facts. It was written by Justice Brennan at the height of the Warren Court. Justice Brennan concluded that this was perfectly reasonable and it was okay to take the blood. Now, writing in the modern world, Justice Sotomayor distinguished Schmerber on factual grounds and relied heavily on the fact that since the 70s, it has been fairly common and authorized for the cops to call a judge on the phone and get a phone warrant, and that therefore there is much less justification in the modern world not to get a warrant since you can do it on the way to the hospital from a phone. This sort of shows, you know, that the case is sort of interesting, but it doesn't matter that much because you'll get nailed on the blood test anyway. Bailey versus the U.S. Is another Fourth Amendment case. There is an old rule called Michigan versus Summers. If you're executing a search warrant, you can detain people on the premises. These guys were executing a search warrant. They saw somebody leave, and they caught it a mile away from the premises. The court said that's not a Michigan versus Summers. Now we get to the interesting, very interesting DNA case. This is our other DNA case, and this involves somebody who gets arrested in Maryland, Maryland versus King, gets taken to a place where a buccal swab, you know, you put like a Q-tip inside your cheek and you get a DNA test, and several months later, it comes back that your DNA tests match that of a rapist who has been at large for years. Mr. King is ultimately convicted of that crime based on the DNA, and he challenges that as a search. You know, the court, 5-4, does agree that that is a search, but it finds that it is a reasonable one. Justice Kennedy concludes that this is a fairly minor intrusion, that it doesn't really take that long or that much. It's not dangerous and is occurring in a setting in which you're already under custody anyway. The main part of the opinion is based on the rationale that a DNA test is just like fingerprints or a photograph is useful in identifying you. Justice Scalia wrote a long and impassioned dissent, which pointed out that no one got the outcome of the test for months and months after the actual arrest, that it had nothing to do with identifying King, since they have his name, his date of birth, and all of the other data that they needed, and that this was a search for a different crime that should have been justified by a warrant. But as of now, you know, the Supreme Court seems firmly of the view that that you can be subjected to DNA testing if you are under arrest. There are a couple of other cases that I guess I better move quickly. There is a case called Salinas versus Texas, a very narrowly divided case. Basically, if you go to the station house on your own and you start answering questions, and then the cops ask you whether the shotgun shells that they have will match your shotgun, and all of a sudden you clam up, the cops can use that silence. It is not a violation of the Fifth Amendment. The defendant said, well, you know, I became silent because I was invoking my First Amendment, you know, my Fifth Amendment right. The court said, no, you have to actually invoke your right as saying, I am taking the Fifth. And we don't actually think that this was an invocation, actually, because all we have is the silence. And for all we know, as Justice Alito put it, he might just have been looking for a good lie. That is, I think, for the criminal cases. There are some habeas cases and some sentencing cases. The short line of that one is that the defendants won pretty much all of the sentencing cases, including the overruling of an earlier case called Harris, and that the warden won, as is usual, most of the habeas cases. If you let me. Now we get to the actual interesting cases of the term. Thank you for staying with me. Wake up. It has to be done. It's a roundup. So we go to the Voting Rights Act. Some years ago, as you may recall, the Chief Justice got 8 votes for his opinion in the Namudno case, where he implored Congress to take a look at the formula in the Voting Rights Act and asked them to look at whether it continued to reflect, you know, the reality that we live under today. Congress was busy, evidently, and didn't get around to doing any of that. And so the case came back to the court, or the issue came back to the court when Shelby County, Alabama, filed a DEC action in federal district court here asking for a facial invalidation of sections 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act. For those of you who don't know, the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. And it dealt in these sections with trying to require certain so-called covered jurisdiction to submit changes in voting laws to either the Justice Department or to a 3-judge court in the district. And they cannot give effect to those changes pending, you know, the outcome of the so-called preclearance. In this Shelby County versus Holder case, you know, the court 5-4 held that the most recent amendment to the Voting Rights Act, which would have extended it into the 2030s without any significant change in the formula that governs the covered jurisdictions in the 70s, was in fact unconstitutional, because there is a very important principle in our law that entitles each state to be the sovereign within its borders, that allows its laws to become effective immediately and not subject to the whim of the federal government. And while you can make distinctions based on the Voting Rights Act, as the court had in the past, they found that the changes since 1965 and 1975, where there has been nearly parity that has been achieved in the formerly covered jurisdictions with the uncovered jurisdictions, do not justify the formula in this day and age. Importantly, the court, although it's sort of an academic exercise, did not strike down Section 5, but only Section 4. Section 5 still continues to require preclearance for covered jurisdictions. Give me some water. And it is up to Congress to come up with a new Section 4 that can identify how to go about getting the covered jurisdictions based on the facts that we know today. Once again, I will point out, sort of in keeping with the point earlier, that the Namudno case, which basically had many of the same considerations that we had in the case in Shelby, was one that was joined by 8 justices. And it was interesting at the time because it was not what one would call the most obvious reading of the statute in that case in order to avoid, you know, the constitutional question, but it was one that was joined by 8 justices. What the liberal justices gained by putting off, you know, the question was another election cycle and a set of ID laws that would not get implemented in the 2012 elections, even though from their point of view, they lost the case at the end of the day. They put off, you know, the day of reckoning by joining a more modest opinion by the Chief Justice in the Namudno case. There is a similar dynamic at work in the next case, which is the affirmative action case from UT Fisher. Fisher, as you know, was widely expected to deal with the question whether the affirmative action cases Grutter and Gratz were going, well, or at least Grutter, were going to be overruled. Now, the court sat on that case for 275 days and then issued a somewhat surprising and very narrow ruling, finding that the Fifth Circuit had failed in the application of the Grutter test, which the court said, for present purposes, we assume to be the law, and sent it back to the Fifth Circuit. And the net-net is that strict scrutiny continued to apply, but the Fifth Circuit was wrong in giving deference to the University of Texas on the question of fit. That opinion was joined by 7 justices, including Justice Breyer and Justice Sotomayor. Justice Kagan did not take part, and Justice Ginsburg did file a dissent, but it's one of those cases in which, while everybody expected that the court was going to tackle the issue of the continuing vitality of the Grutter case, the court, as in the Namudno case, put the day of reckoning off, with several of the liberal justices joining to put that day of reckoning off, hoping once again, I think that, you know, the day will come when the issue will come back to the court and the court will be composed differently. I think for those of you who have been patiently waiting, we now go to the gay stuff, which is 2 equal protection cases. Excuse me. Hollingsworth and Windsor. In the Hollingsworth case, as you all know, consulted the constitutionality of Proposition 8, which is a state ballot initiative that defined marriage in California as only, you know, the union of a man and a woman. The case had been won by my partner Ted Olson in district court. There was an appeal to the Ninth Circuit that ultimately affirmed. One of the questions that the Ninth Circuit considered was whether the interveners who had been the proponents of the ballot initiative had standing to come into the case and defend because the Attorney General and the Governor of California declined to defend the law. The Supreme Court of California held that they did have standing and that they could assert their interest because that was needed under state law to make the initiative process work when the state officials actually declined to defend the will of the people. In a 5-4 ruling, the court concluded that there was no standing in the case. and that the correct outcome was to leave the judgment of the district court undisturbed. The court relied on the fact that although, as a matter of state law, the proponents of Proposition 8 were authorized to do this, they themselves had suffered no specific injury that was personal to them, and that their authorization to act on behalf of the state could not really, in fact, make them de facto public officials. The court had a very impassioned dissent by Justice Kennedy, who felt very strongly that this is an essential part of democracy in California, and that the court had, in order to vindicate democracy in California and elsewhere, should have gotten to the merits. As we shall soon see, what that actually means is that we should get to the merits to vindicate the democracy and call, you know, the voters biased and benighted. But he nonetheless felt that we should get to the merits in that case. In the Windsor case, dealt with the constitutionality of Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act, which, as you may recall, was passed in the Clinton administration with lopsided majorities in Congress. The plaintiff in the case had lost her spouse. She had not been given the estate tax exemption that you would get when you lose a spouse, and therefore she sued to have Section 3 of DOMA invalidated. In an opinion by Justice Kennedy, he agreed. He concluded that DOMA was either a violation of federalism or of equal protection or both. You know, the opinion is a little bit unclear as to exactly what the ultimate basis for the ruling is, but he did conclude that there was an aspect to the federal statute that was essentially an exercise in bias and malice on the part of the electorate, and that this was not a legitimate state interest. As a result of that, he held the act, or this aspect of the act, unconstitutional. Before he could get there, he had to contend with the fact that in the DOMA case, the Obama administration had also, like California in the Prop 8 case, not fought with the other side, which is to say, Edith Windsor sued and the Obama administration agreed that she was entitled to the money. Nonetheless, Justice Kennedy concluded that there was standing because the parties that had been represented by Paul Clement, which was basically the bipartisan members of Congress who came in defense of the statute, had given enough of an adversary presentation. Justice Kennedy was especially persuaded in finding standing in the DOMA case by the fact that Ms. Windsor was seeking money from found that the statute is indeed unconstitutional. Justice Scalia's dissent, as I pointed out earlier, is notable for pillaring Justice Kennedy and taking pains to demonstrate that the opinion in the case effectively answers the question that the court didn't get to in the Prop 8 case, which is to say the constitutionality of non-same-sex marriage statutes, which is an approach quite different from the Chief Justice, who also wrote an opinion in the same case trying to cast the opinion purely as a federalism opinion. Justice Scalia will hear none of that and basically claim that all of these issues are over. He may well be right. We will see in the latest cases. For those of you who enjoy his turns of phrases, you know, my favorite one in this opinion was when he described Justice Kennedy's opinion as a disappearing trail of legalistic argle-bargle, which is something I had never heard about, but it's quite entertaining. In closing, as I pointed out, since I think not even coffee will keep you awake at this point, let me just mention a couple of cases that are teed up for the next term. Doug mentioned, you know, the recess or non-recess appointments case, which promises to be a really important case next term. There is a case called McCutcheon versus FEC, Federal Election Commission, that people are touting as the next Citizens United, and that's all the left-wing blogs who are really afraid of the case. And there's a very interesting case called Greece, New York, which is a town in New York versus Galloway, that presents the question of the constitutionality of legislative invocations, praying to the Almighty and the light, which the court had not ruled on since it upheld them with respect to Congress in Marsh versus Chambers in 1983. I think that's all I have today. You have been extremely patient. I'm sorry that some of it was slow and boring, but I did find time to get to the gay stuff. Thank you for taking the time to come.
Thank you so much, Miguel. It's a wonderful job of summarizing a quite interesting term, as you say, unlike the last one you summarized. We really appreciate it. We have a tradition of giving our speakers a leather-bound copy of the Federalist Papers, but when speakers have been here more than once, as Miguel has, we substitute something else. And thank you very much. This is some nice cufflinks for
thank you. Thank
you
so much. And, I was expecting a shotgun.
Well, I hadn't heard your Biden discussion before. I would have complied.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.